Nevertheless, she was relieved when Megan called to the front of the van and asked the driver if he could please get them a little more air here in the back. The traffic wasn't much better on the Sheikh Zayed, the highway. Even when the loudspeakers on the minarets started to broadcast the muezzin's midday call to worship. By the time they arrived at the airport, they had to rush straight to the plane. It was ready, and almost miraculously, they still had a shot at an on-time departure. Megan was the cabin service director on this flight, and Shane was the purser. Once more, Cassie would be in first class. Her July bid included both the route, Paris-Dubai, and the cabin, first. The Sky Marshal, a heavy-set American in a nondescript windbreaker, with an aisle seat in the last row of the first-class cabin, seemed to be watching her as he settled in for the flight. But she took a breath and told herself that she was being paranoid. The safety briefing was a video, but she was still expected to remain alert in the front of the aisle to encourage the passengers to actually pay attention. In this cabin, none ever did. Some wouldn't even take off their headphones or look up from their tablets or newspapers. It wasn't merely that they were all frequent flyers and knew the drill. It was that there was a certain machismo to not watching. To look up and listen suggested you were either afraid of flying or an outsider at 35,000 feet. You were a newbie. She started to turn back to the galley as the unduly cheerful video prattled on and caught the heel of her pump on the tacking strip and stumbled. A Saudi executive in a pristine white thobe caught her with his left arm before she fell. "Thank you," she said. She was embarrassed. She couldn't recall ever tripping on a plane when they were still parked at the gate. It was one thing to lose your balance when you were flying and there was turbulence. But on the ground, this was new. That was unexpected.
"I'm happy I could help," he told her.
He had a wide, magnanimous smile. He adjusted the gutra that covered his neck and hair, its ikal a thick black halo. Then he returned to the business magazine he was reading on his tablet. When she was back on her feet and standing with the galley and flight deck behind her, the only person watching her was the Sky Marshal. She wondered if he could sense, rather like a lion, her fear. They were held at the gate and lost their on-time departure. She hadn't seen a conga line on the runway, but the minutes ticked by. Then the captain told the crew, and then he told the passengers the reason for the delay. Thunderstorms across the eastern Mediterranean and southern Europe. They would be here perhaps half an hour. She tried to believe this was the case, that all that was holding them up was the weather. But her anxiety only grew more pronounced. Still, she worked. She and Megan brought the first-class cabin drinks and more drinks, and then they brought them mixed nuts they warmed in the ovens. The passengers in economy could only suffer in silence and fret that they would miss their connections at Charles de Gaulle. Cassie would glance out the windows, half expecting to see police vans converging upon the plane from the tunnels that snaked underneath the airport. She would pause before the front cabin door, fearing there was someone on the other side signaling her to open it. Open it right now. There in her mind was the captain, emerging from the flight deck, nodding, giving her permission, because airport security was about to pull somebody off the plane. Occasionally, she checked her phone to see if there were news stories of a hedge fund manager from America found dead in a Dubai hotel room, but there seemed to be nothing on Twitter or any of the news sites, at least the English sites that she could Google and read. Finally, the jet bridge was retracted, and Stewart instructed them to make sure that the cabin was prepared for takeoff. He said it was time to strap in. They began their taxi, and then they were rolling down the runway, and she felt the shimmy that suggested they were seconds from wheels up. And then they were. They were climbing, airborne, and they were leaving Dubai. They were, once more, leaving behind the indoor ski resort, The massive, man-made marinas in the shape of palm trees you could see from space, and the skyline with its towering futuristic needles. The vending machines that sold gold. They were soaring over the endless rows of oil wells and oil rigs. From the sky, they looked like industrious black ants chained in place to the ground. And then the desert. Endless, flat, and unfurling in waves and ripples and hillocks to the western horizon. And with that came the tears. They were as unexpected as they were unstoppable, and she allowed them to slide down her face and muck up her mascara. She cried silently, aware that none of the passengers could see her here in her jump seat. Megan might look over and wonder at what a hot mess she had become, but Megan had flown with her enough to know that she would rally. She cried, she guessed, in some small way because she was so deeply relieved. She was leaving the Arabian Peninsula, where it was hard enough to be a woman, and probably a disaster if you were a woman that men believed had nearly decapitated some poor money manager in an inexplicable fit of Arak-fueled post-coital madness. But she was crying mostly, she realized, out of grief and sorrow and loss. Now that the self-preservation that had gotten her this far had begun to dissolve, she thought about the man she had left behind. And for the first time, the shock evaporating like the morning haze she'd recall as the sun would rise over the Cumberland Mountains, she began to feel the despair that walks hand in hand with bereavement. She made a litany in her mind of the little she knew of Alex Sokolov's personal life. He was an only child. His parents in Charlottesville were starting to toy with the idea of retirement, though it was still a good ways off. God, that only reminded her of how young he was. His parents had yet to retire. He said he had been with the fund nearly 4 years, and that's what he called it whenever it came up, the fund. And before that, he'd worked for Goldman Sachs. But he had worked in money management since getting some sort of master's in math. Quantitative something and finance something, in Durham. In the same way that he only offered the name of his employer when she asked, he only said Duke when she pressed for more details. He preferred Tolstoy and Turgenev to Dostoevsky, but encouraged her to reread all three writers, as an adult instead of a student pulling an all-nighter. He had not simply gotten them a table for two at the French bistro a couple of blocks from his hotel. He had paid off the maitre d' to seat them in a corner and not seat anyone else at the table beside them. At first, she'd viewed the move as pretentious male swagger, but as they were approaching their table, he had whispered into her ear that he viewed romance as a totally private matter, and he wanted to romance her that night. Later, he would pick up a tab that dwarfed what she usually spent over 3 nights in Paris and Dubai. It was more than she spent most months on groceries. He had ordered the Blanquette de Veau, and she had ordered the Coq au Vin, joking that after all the arrack they had consumed, it only made sense for her to eat chicken and wine, though, of course, he reminded her, the alcohol would have cooked away. They had enjoyed their meal, savoring the seclusion, and taken their time. They finished a bottle of wine and then ordered still more arrack. And yet, despite how far down the alcohol rabbit hole they fell there, they never lost sight of the fact they were in Dubai. They both had been here before and knew that the penalties for public drunkenness were not pretty. The two of them were far from raucous. They flirted in their own little alcove, but didn't touch. He kept his voice low as he told her the things he wanted to do to her in his hotel room once he joined her there. He slid his room key across the tablecloth, and she shivered ever so slightly when their fingertips touched. When the police would follow his credit card to the restaurant, people would recall he had been with a woman who was likely from America, because the two of them had spoken English like Americans. Someone might recall that she was older than he was. But had they stood out? A bit, yes, because they had indeed ordered arak and wine, and then more arak. But she was confident that at least half, perhaps even two-thirds, of the diners in the restaurant were Westerners. They hadn't made a scene. He liked soccer, she remembered, and had played it at college. He liked squash even more, and played it still. The notion that he, too, was a boozer, at least for one night, caused her to feel a deep, wistful ache in her heart. Everyone who drank the way she did had a reason, she supposed, and she had never pressed him for his. Did he have one? Now she'd never know. Certainly he had never wondered about her own private pain. He smoked. She hadn't kissed a man in a while who did, and with Alex it hadn't been like kissing an ashtray. It had felt decadent in all the right ways. He said he only smoked when he traveled overseas. In his hotel room, they had started on the bed as soon as he'd returned, atop the crimson bedspread, but then he had brought her to the shower. She'd been surprised, unsure whether she should be more stunned by his astonishing willpower that moment, or insulted in some way that she didn't quite want to parse. But she had gone along, and she was glad. They had made love there, her knees on that marble bench, his hands and fingers around her, between her legs, and then he had washed her hair. And that recollection made her choke on a small, audible sob, right there in her jump seat. "God, you're crying," Megan whispered, her tone walking the tightrope between solicitous and annoyed. "Can I do something?"
"No."
"Then what's wrong?" Cassie sniffed and wiped her face with her fingers.
"I don't know," she lied. "I swear I don't, but I'm fine. Or I'll be fine."
Afterward, Miranda had arrived. Then Miranda had left, and Cassie had planned to leave too. But Alex had led her instead back to that astonishing bedroom where they had made love again. They polished off the little bottle of arak they found in the minibar. At least she believed at the time they had finished it, when she had wiped the blue glass down with the washcloth in the morning, she had heard some liquid sloshing around the bottom. Then they went back to the vodka. For some reason, he'd had trouble unscrewing the cap and accidentally broken the bottle on the side of the nightstand. Or had he smashed it on purpose in frustration? Instead of cleaning it up, they just laughed. She thought she had gotten dressed to leave, but it was less than a blur, it was a void. She'd been naked when she awoke. What the hell happened to climbing back into her skirt and blouse and returning to her hotel? God, it was just like so many of the other times she had woken up naked and hung over in bed with a guy, with only the slightest idea how she had gotten there. Except this time, the guy was dead. She took stock once more, trying to make sense of what she had done, what she might have done. Had he attacked her and she had defended herself? Possibly, but not likely. They'd had sex twice, that she could recall. Still, no means no. Passed out isn't consent. What if behind the blackout is this? He is trying to have sex with her, and she is resisting. They're drunk. They're both drunk. He is upon her, he won't stop, and she is pounding him on his head, his face, his back. She is trying to scratch him, and he is just growing angrier and more violent. She sees nearby the remnants of that bottle of Stoli. Perhaps some of the broken pieces are even on the nightstand. She reaches for one, the jagged shoulder maybe, gripping the neck like a knife, and she lashes out at him. She slashes him across his throat. She can see in her mind the backhand motion, the resultant gash. And then she falls back to sleep. She wished she had looked more closely at the body that morning. She hadn't. She saw Alex's neck, and that was enough. She had seen his eyes were closed, but otherwise she hadn't studied his head or his back or his arms. She honestly didn't know precisely where else she might have stabbed him. And yet, when she looked back on her history, it just didn't make sense that she would have attacked him if he was trying once again to have sex with her. A part of her life was, dear God, blackout sex. It happened. She knew from too many mornings with too many creepy guys that it did. She presumed, and the idea caused her stomach once more to churn, that she was more likely to allow herself to be raped. To be raped. The awfulness of the expression led her to groan softly to herself. Even if she hadn't killed Alex Sokolov, however, she had cut and run. That was a fact. The poor guy had parents and friends, and he had bled to death in the bed right beside her, and she had left him. "You're not fine," Megan murmured. "This is different from your other, I don't know, stunts. Something happened." "Nothing happened. People don't cry over nothing." But then there was the plane's chime, and they were above 10,000 feet, and she could no longer cry. She had to start work. She had to wash her face and reapply her makeup. She unstrapped and stood, resolved to be as charming and efficient as ever. And yet, as she stared at herself in the small mirror in the small bathroom, as she looked at the lines she was hiding under her eyes, the lines she artfully concealed beside her eyes, as she noted the way that the blue of her iris seemed a little less vibrant than it had when she was young, even surrounded by the moth silk lines of hangover red around them, she felt the tears welling up once again. She recalled something her father had said to her when she was a little girl. "You bury the dead and move on." It was a few years before he was so hammered that he crashed the Dodge Colt into a telephone pole with his younger daughter in the back seat. It was long before he accidentally, at least she presumed it was accidental, killed himself and a couple of teenagers who were driving home from Lexington and happened to be in the right lane when he, drunk again, was in the wrong one. She'd been 8 at the time he'd given her this piece of advice, and she hadn't, as she had hoped, been allowed to ascend to the next level ballet class with two of her friends. The teacher didn't believe she was ready. Her father had tried to console her. "Well," he said, "sometimes you just have to bury the dead and move on." Her father, alas, never took that advice. After his wife, her mother, died, he only drank more. And Cassie had neither forgotten nor gotten over the counsel he had offered her when she was in the 3rd grade. She would think of it when her mother would die when she was 15, and when her father would die when she was 19, and often after bidding farewell to the men she had seduced or been seduced by, especially those times when she would be so drunk that she hadn't insisted they wear one of the condoms she carried with her wherever she went. The truth was, there was nothing casual about casual sex. When it worked, it was intense. When it didn't, it was particularly unsatisfying. Either way, it left scars, some that were similar to the blackout scars, but some that were different. The violation was less pronounced, but the self-loathing could be fierce. One time she had shared her father's wisdom with a stranger in bed. It was another morning after, and they were agreeing rather amicably that the night before had been a drunken, god-awful mistake. They might have become friends and should never have slept together. He, in return, had observed that as dark and inappropriate as the advice might have been, it was about what you might expect from a dad who had named his first daughter Cassandra. Likewise, there was no longer anything casual about her drinking, and there hadn't been for years. There was a knock on the bathroom door, and then Megan's voice.
"Cassie, I hate to be a pain, but you are either okay to work this flight or you're not. This is the last time I am going to ask."
Cassie imagined this was what Megan sounded like when she was urging one of her daughters to buck up and behave. The other flight attendant had beautiful children and a husband who was a management consultant in Washington, D.C., and a lovely house in Northern Virginia. The woman had it all. She really did.
Cassie?
She stood up straight in the bathroom. "I'll be right out," she said. "I'll be ready to rock and roll." Then she brushed her mascara back onto her eyelashes and ran the new lipstick she'd bought at the airport over her mouth. Landing lips, they called it. She was quick but careful. The shade was similar to the one she had lost in Dubai. And then she emerged, promising herself that if somehow this all turned out okay, she was never going to drink again. Never. She made this promise, or one like it, monthly. But this time, she told herself that she meant it.
Chapter 4 Elena supposed that among the reasons why she was good at what she did was the simple reality that she was neither beautiful nor homely. She could look pretty when she dressed well and wore the right makeup, and so she tried to do both, but the goal was not to stand out. She was 5'4", with deep brown eyes and chestnut brown hair, which she kept parted in the middle when she wasn't working, and in a French twist when she was. She rarely wore sunglasses in America and Russia, because she thought that sunglasses made you more noticeable. She realized here in Dubai that the opposite was true. It was the Westerners who didn't wear sunglasses who were the most memorable. And so she bought a first pair soon after landing and a second pair at one of the hotel stores right after finishing her iced tea with Victor. She was walking through the souk, her headscarf pulled tight, and she rather liked the absolute anonymity. She stood in a narrow aisle of spices, unsure whether the smell nearest her was cumin or the merchant. Elena didn't cook much, but she had used cumin just enough to know that the stench could be either. He was standing behind the long buffet of containers, rich with the phosphorescent colors of saffron and curry. On the racks behind him were small glass replicas of the most prominent new buildings in Dubai, each a little reminiscent of a chess piece. She'd loved chess as a child. She'd played it at school and at home with her father until she was sent away to a boarding school in Switzerland. She was rather good at it. Beside the trinket buildings were a variety of ornate, ocean-blue hookahs. She appreciated the way the market seemed to cater to both locals and tourists, though she could imagine tourists bringing home spices as well as a souvenir Burj Al Arab, the iconic Dubai hotel that looked like a gigantic, as in 56-story gigantic, sale. She thought of the Eastern Market near the apartment she'd had when she'd been in Washington, D.C. a few years ago, and how you could find there fresh local fruit as well as paperweight-sized Washington monuments and snow globes of the White House. Now she looked up because the spice vendor was asking her if she spoke English. She nodded and smiled. "What would you like?" he inquired. He was an older man, his beard trim and gray. His thobe was spotless, as white as the cherry blossoms and not a stain on it, despite the spices that surrounded him. There really was nothing here that she wanted, at least today. The apartment they had given her had a tidy kitchen, but she didn't know yet how long she would be in Dubai. A week or two, she expected, but the next few days would tell. They wanted to be sure there was no fallout from Alex Sokolov that she would need to clean up. God, she thought. Imagine if they knew about the flight attendant. She felt a deep pang of disquiet, almost alarm, when she imagined the possible repercussions from her decision not to kill her, too. She took a breath to calm herself, to compartmentalize. It was, she understood, how she functioned. She was capable of focusing acutely on a problem and thinking many steps ahead. It was why she had been such a capable chess player. She could be farsighted to the point of prescience. But her mind also divided and conquered, squirreling away the nuggets she someday might need, while putting the fears that might paralyze her behind a firewall. "Please," the vendor was saying to her, "a beautiful woman like you? Surely there is something you want." She looked at him, and then she looked around at his wares. In her opinion, the real fun of a place like the souk was not merely how fresh everything was, but the negotiating, the bargaining. It was rather like low-stakes diplomacy. Elena loved it. She was only 30, barely 30, but she had spent enough time in cities in the Middle East that she had grown accustomed to the haggling it took to buy a brick of halloumi cheese. So she guessed she would purchase something. But then her phone vibrated. She thanked the vendor and turned away to read the text. It was from Victor. Alex Sokolov had indeed missed the meeting that morning with the investors from Russia. They'd called his cell and they'd called the hotel and left messages. Most of the people in the room had no idea why he wasn't there, but there were a few who did, and they were grateful. She took in his praise, but she didn't smile. She knew that while she was indeed proficient, no, she was beyond proficient, she had, to use an expression a roommate from college rather liked, mad skills. Second chances were few in her line of work, especially with these people, her father's people. She knew the truth of what they had done to him. She wasn't irreplaceable. The last thing she wanted was to be herself among the hunted. But Victor's text was reassuring. He had even used the word grateful. And so she turned back to the vendor and pointed at a beautiful scarf so gloriously colorful and luminescent that she thought of Joseph's dream coat. "How many dirhams?" she asked. He told her. She scoffed and rolled her eyes, and he gave her a second price. And they were off.
Chapter 5. The moment they had touched down at Charles de Gaulle and were taxiing to their gate, Cassie checked her phone for news from Dubai. She found none. It was possible, though unlikely, she believed, that Alex's body had not yet been discovered. It was nearly 8:30 at night in the United Emirates. If his corpse, dear God, what a horrible word, were still in the bed where she had left it, that would mean that the Royal Phoenician housekeeping team had respected the Do Not Disturb sign through cleaning and turndown service. Whoever delivered the complimentary fresh fruit and mamul cookies late that afternoon had seen the sign and returned to the hotel kitchen. It meant that neither Miranda nor some other business associate had gone looking for him or questioned, at least with any resolve, his peculiar and unexplained absence. In the end, she concluded that by now the macerating remains of Alex Sokolov had most definitely been found. Had to have been. In her mind, as she thanked the passengers as they disembarked, she saw a forensics team scouring the room, that body in the bed gone but the sheets a Rorschach of red. Normally, she would have viewed the scheduling gods as having been kind to her, because the airline was only required to give them 10 hours of rest. But they had had 21 hours in Dubai, and they were going to have nearly 15 here in France. Now, however, the duration only ratcheted up her anxiety. She wanted to be back in the United States. She wanted to be back in her apartment on 27th Street in Manhattan. She wanted to know that she would have access to American lawyers, if it ever came to that. This crew, the 13 of them, had one last leg together, the return to JFK tomorrow morning, and then they would scatter. Their paths might cross again in different combinations, especially she and Megan and Shane, because they enjoyed each other's company and occasionally worked their schedules so they could fly together. But this particular chemical arrangement of pilots and flight attendants would never be duplicated. The airline had nearly 1,200 flight attendants based in New York, all of them bidding monthly on the routes and the cabins, and somehow she and Megan and Shane had all gotten Paris. Though, in this sequence, the price had come with Dubai. Two nights ago, on the way east, the three of them had catnapped in the morning and then spent a lovely afternoon and evening at a bistro and then a nightclub with hipsters half their age near the Bastille. The overnight, then, had been a lot longer than this one. Cassie had drunk that evening, but not to excess, and she hadn't separated from her friends. It dawned on her that she shouldn't return to Dubai, at least not in the foreseeable future. Probably ever. It wasn't on her schedule next month, and she sure as hell wouldn't bid on it for September.
I don't think anyone's going into the city this time, Megan was saying as they emerged from the jet bridge into the concourse. Tonight the airline had them at an airport hotel because it just took too long to get in and out of Paris, and the overnight was much shorter.
But there's a pretty nice restaurant near the hotel we can walk to. Brasserie something. Anyway, some of us are meeting in the lobby at 7. Do you want to join us?
No, I think I'm going to rest, she said.
I think that makes sense, Megan agreed. Be a slam clicker for a change. Get some sleep.
They passed a Hermes boutique, and she recalled the leopard print scarf that she had seen in a store last night at the Royal Phoenician. She thought of her neck. She thought of his. Alex's.
Treat yourself. Order something light from room service. Eat dessert first,
Megan went on. Yeah, I think that's the plan.
God, you have no idea how nice it is as a mother of two hormonally insane teenagers, sometimes just to have an evening alone in a hotel room. I might not go out either. I might just Skype Vaughn and call it a night, she said.
Cassie nodded politely. She'd met Megan's husband a couple of times. He seemed nice enough. She remembered mostly the jokes he had made about being a consultant.
You really only need to get two things to be a consultant. Fired and business cards. You want to know the definition of a consultant? A guy who borrows your watch to tell you what time it is.
But since the family had moved to Virginia, he had worked a lot for Defense Department contractors, so Cassie presumed he was far more competent than his self-deprecation suggested. And his jokes certainly had been no worse than those of the first officer she was flying with that week. At that moment, Stewart was regaling the captain with yet another story that was, invariably, a little stale. "Say hi to him for me," she told Megan.
"I will, and you get some rest."
Cassie nodded. She knew she would be tempted to order a glass of wine, but she was also confident that she would be able to resist. She reminded herself that she tended to binge drink, and yes, to binge sex. But she wasn't really a drunk like her father. Sure, that was the motto of unredeemed alcoholics everywhere. "I'm not really a drunk." But she wasn't. She went nights all the time without drinking. Hadn't she vowed only hours earlier that she'd never drink again? She had. Not quite 5 minutes later, they were nearing the exit beside the security queues and the escalator down to the strip of exterior sidewalk where they would wait for the hotel shuttle, when Jada stopped and handed Megan her phone. The entire crew stopped with her, a herd of gazelle on alert.
"Recognize him?" Jada asked.
Megan enlarged the photo with her index finger and thumb.
"Oh my God," she murmured softly, a little stunned. "Wow. He was on the flight with us from Paris to Dubai."
"Yep." Megan gave the phone to Cassie, but didn't say a word. For a long moment, she stared at the photo, and it was one of those experiences where she was both reacting to it viscerally and reacting to it with the awareness of a performer, because she knew that Megan was watching her. There he was. Last night's lover. The story about him was on a site they all visited on occasion that helped international travelers keep up with international crime, a sort of tabloid version of the State Department's travel advisory website. It was brief and to the point. There had been a rather grisly murder at the Royal Phoenician in Dubai. The victim, a hedge fund manager from the United States named Alex Sokolov, had had his throat slashed in his hotel room. He had been found mid-afternoon when he had missed a meeting he had been expected to attend. Finally, hotel security had ignored the "Do Not Disturb" sign and entered the suite. There were no other names in the story, so there was no mention of a woman named Miranda.
"I am so sorry," Cassie said, hoping that her shock that the body now was news would be construed by Megan and the crew as shock that the body existed at all, that the poor guy had been murdered. She scrolled down a little further and learned that the authorities had no serious suspects. A travel and tourism official was insisting that this was an isolated incident and visitors needn't be alarmed. But a police captain seemed to dispute that by arguing that they had not ruled out burglary as a motive. Megan took the phone and gave it back to Jada, and she in turn handed it to Stuart and the captain to share. It was interesting to all of them that a passenger on their plane had been murdered. Then Megan leaned in close to Cassie and whispered, "Swear to me you know nothing about this." "Of course not. Why would I?" She hoped that she sounded offended. "Okay. It's just that you two are talking a lot on the flight to Dubai. And then you seemed so off your game and so freaking weird when we were on our way to the airport this morning. And then you were crying when we took off." She shook her head. "Oh, I guess I'm sad that the young man is dead. He seemed like a nice enough guy. But the last time I saw him was when he got off the plane yesterday afternoon." The herd started to move, and she started to move with it. A part of her feared that each lie was going to bury her deeper. But she also told herself that it was far too late to start telling the truth. Cassie lay on her side in her hotel room bed in the dark, naked but for the white terry cloth robe she had found in the closet. She listened to the sounds of the footsteps and the rolling suitcases along the corridor, flinching whenever she heard a door slam or a lock click shut. She tried once more to recall missing details from the night before, but they were lost. She tried to recall every word she had said to Miranda, but so much of the conversation existed in the murk that shrouded the events and the men and the bars and the beds from so many nights over so many years. At one point, she considered texting her sister in Kentucky, asking a few harmless questions about her nephew or niece, about her brother-in-law. She and her sister rarely spoke of their father and mother, because invariably they wound up fighting whenever they did. There was just so much anger and just so much hurt, and they had responded to their parents in ways as different and unique as snowflakes. They were not close anymore, and probably never would be close again. But Rosemary needed Cassie to be at least on the periphery of her family's life to feed her own longing for normalcy. Occasionally, Rosemary and her husband, Dennis, and their two kids would fly in from Kentucky and stay at an inexpensive hotel in Westchester for the weekend, and then take the train or drive a rental car into the city on Saturday and Sunday. Rosemary was an accountant in Lexington. Dennis worked at the military base in Richmond. Sometimes on these family visits to the city, Cassie would be granted a brief audience alone with either her nephew or niece. She would be allowed to bring Jessica to the American Girl store, or Tim to the Metropolitan Museum. A few times she had even gotten to take the children to lunch, just the three of them, and she had brought them to restaurants they had adored. The sort of places where there were young waiters and waitresses singing show tunes, or the dining room was designed to replicate a haunted house. Cassie cherished those hours. She couldn't imagine she was ever going to have children of her own, a reality that some solitary nights would leave her feeling bereft of the son or daughter she'd never hold. Usually, however, when her sister's family came to New York, she would see the kids and their parents together. The five of them would go to the top of the Empire State Building, the Statue of Liberty, Yankee Stadium when the Royals were in town, so together they could root against the evil empire. These weekends were free of alcohol because Rosemary didn't drink and didn't want to see her sister drink. That's how different they were. It spoke volumes about what Rosemary really thought of her that the children had never been alone with Cassie in her apartment. She had offered to babysit them at least half a dozen times so Rosemary and Dennis could enjoy a night out alone. See a musical, perhaps, that wasn't Disney. Enjoy a restaurant where the ladies and men's rooms didn't have signs marked witches and warlocks. but her sister had always passed, said she and Dennis wanted family time with the kids. In truth, Cassie knew, Rosemary didn't trust her at night. It was when their father often, but not always, got into trouble, and it was when Cassie seemed to inflict the most hurt, on herself and on others. And so she didn't text her sister. There was really no point. She didn't once reach for her phone as it charged on the nightstand. She was afraid that the urge to Google Alex Sokolov would be irresistible, and now that she knew his body had been found and the investigation had begun, she wanted to secrete herself inside a news void. She was afraid that anything she might learn would only make her feel worse. Either it would frighten her, a noose drawing tight, or it would exacerbate her guilt for telling no one that she'd found him dead and then just left the body behind. That night, she only got out of bed when she needed water or had to go to the bathroom. She awoke, the air dense with the distant remnants of a dream. The room was silent except for the thrum of the cool, forced air, and the details of the dream were all but gone. Her father was in it, that she knew, and so was hunting camp. But that was it. She rubbed her eyes. 2 seasons she had gone hunting with him and one of his few friends, even though it had meant missing dance class. The camp was in the Cumberland Mountains, and it belonged to that friend, a carpenter who had a daughter roughly her age. She had come too. The girl's name was Carly, and she went to a different school. The camp was actually a trailer with plumbing that no longer worked, and so the carpenter had built an outhouse. A composting, eco-friendly outhouse. Those 2 November weekends, a year apart, had been at once unbelievably wholesome and unbelievably squalid. The fathers had viewed themselves as progressive and enlightened. They were bringing their daughters to deer camp. They'd sent them to hunter safety courses and then refined what the instructors had taught them about firearms. But the men had drunk and passed out each night, and then each day the 4 of them had walked forever in the cold of the woods. It didn't snow either year, thank God, but that also meant there hadn't been any tracks. The 2nd year she'd wounded a deer instead of killing it instantly, which left her sobbing with remorse. Inevitably, it had died, but it had died slowly and in excruciating pain. She'd been such a mess that her father hadn't been able to leave her and track down the animal to finish it off. And Carly? Carly just wanted to drink with her father and with Cassie's dad those weekends, even though the grown-ups wouldn't let her because the girls were still in middle school. She went on and on about how much she loved the foam and fizz of canned beer and how popping the top turned her on, whispered to Cassie that it got her hot. When Cassie finally climbed from the hotel bed, reflexively she rubbed her right shoulder where the rifle's kickback that day in the woods had bruised her soul far worse than her skin. She hadn't touched a gun ever since. It was somewhere over the eastern Atlantic, after she had brought the woman in 6G another glass of Riesling, and Jada had brought the fellow in 3A a scotch, that the other flight attendant verbalized the truth that, along with so many others, had kept Cassie staring at the pinpricks of light in her hotel room the night before. The radio, the clock, the smoke alarm. The 2 of them were catching their breath together in the front galley of the Airbus. "Since he was an American and he was on our flight, do you think they're going to want to talk to us?" Jada asked. Cassie didn't have to ask who he was. "And who do you think they will be?" Cassie rubbed Purell roughly onto her hands. She had contemplated this, too, in the small hours of the morning. She had settled on the FBI, but only because she was pretty sure that the CIA didn't investigate crime. She presumed the FBI must have some sort of arrangement with foreign police forces. Maybe in this case, because Alex had been a U.S. citizen, they would ask the questions for the police in Dubai. But maybe not. She knew that Dubai did so much business with the West that it was very likely they had a pretty damn impressive police force. She also suspected that most U.S. embassies had some sort of FBI presence, an officer or two, just in case. God, if only Alex had been as Russian as his cologne or his taste in literature. She guessed in that case that the questioning would have been cursory, if at all. Why would Americans even investigate a dead Russian in Dubai? They wouldn't. It would be none of their business. In the end, however, by the time she had climbed from the hotel bed and showered, she had convinced herself that even the State Department would be involved. Alex's family would be lobbying the media for justice. People, powerful people, would be paying attention. The idea made her sick. Somewhere Miranda was sharing her story. "I think it will be the FBI," she told Jada finally, "if it's anyone." "I'm not sure I've ever been that close to a person who was murdered." "Me either," she said, though she thought of her father, and briefly her mind dissected the distinctions between manslaughter and murder. Abruptly, Jada looked over Cassie's shoulder, her gaze intense and her dark eyes widening. Cassie felt a sharp spike of fear and turned around, convinced this was it. It was over. An air marshal was about to arrest her just as Jada pushed past. And there she saw the other flight attendant helping a young mother with a toddler in her arms, lifting up the diaper bag that was twisting upside down on the woman's shoulder. The diapers and wipes and the sippy cup in the shape of a bunny all about to tumble onto the floor of the aircraft right in front of the starboard side first-class bathroom. The mom thanked her, rolling her eyes at the nearness of the disaster, and the two of them laughed. Jada was asking the little boy's name as Cassie leaned against the wall with the trolleys and the trash bin, at once relieved and appalled. She wondered, was this sort of adrenal overreaction going to be the norm for the rest of her life? As she was wrapping her shoulder harness around her in the jump seat in the front of the plane, as the Long Island coastline and beaches were racing below them, she thought of the three words she hoped never to say aloud or hear on an aircraft. Brace for impact. That was the signal they were about to crash land or auger in. Those four syllables? They were the cry of the raven. Imminent collision with the ground. Best case, a belly flop, and worst case, a head-on, nose-first crash that would cause the aircraft to break apart and explode. The bodies, the pieces of the bodies that were recognizable. Small, charred briquettes. The words came to her because the captain had informed the crew somewhere over New Brunswick that they were going to be met at the gate at JFK by the authorities. He didn't say why, and whether by authorities he meant airport or TSA officials or some other law enforcement group, and no one on the crew was going to ask him. But they all had their suspicions. Some guessed there was a possible terrorist on board, someone high on the watch list, and the passenger would be arrested the moment they landed. But Cassie had flown long enough to know this wasn't the case. If the captain had been told there might be a terrorist on the plane, he would have informed the crew so they could keep an eye on him every single moment they were in the air. Instead, as they had prepared the cabins for arrival, Megan and Jada and Shane had speculated aloud that it had something to do with the dead American in Dubai. What else could it possibly be, Megan had asked. He'd been with them on the flight from Paris to the Middle East. Cassie considered asking Megan to cover for her. Not necessarily lie, but simply not volunteer the information that Cassandra Bowden had returned to the crew's Dubai hotel in the morning, barely 20 minutes before they had to leave for the airport. Cassie knew it would be easier to simply tell investigators that she had spent the night alone in her own room at the airline's hotel than have to make up a man to account for her absence. But asking that of Megan would only implicate her further in the other woman's eyes. It would convince Megan that she had indeed been with Alex the night he had died, and very possibly had killed him. Already Cassie had felt her friend watching her as they had walked up the aisles, the two of them checking to be sure the passengers were belted in and their seatbacks were upright. And so she focused right now on concocting two possible stories. If she had the sense from the questioning that Miranda had not yet come forward, she would share with the authorities another hotel and another man, molding him in her mind like a golem. She would keep it simple. Give them a name and admit that she was sure the fellow had made it up because she was sure he was married. She was going to say he was some sort of consultant and she thought he was South African. The hotel would be the Armani because it was big and it was in the opposite direction from the Royal Phoenician. And the floor with his room had been somewhere in the middle. Could have been on the 6th, and it could have been on the 8th. She would confess, sheepishly, that she had been drinking, and she couldn't remember very much. Surely there was a single man in a room on one of those floors who spoke English with an accent, she could say later, if necessary. She must have mistaken for South African. But otherwise, she would say almost nothing. That was what mattered. It would be much easier to keep her story straight if the details were few. But what if Miranda had now told the Dubai police that she had met a flight attendant named Cassie the night before, and they had already informed the FBI in America? That would demand a very different lie. One that was more dangerous, but in some ways a much easier one to pull off. That lie was simply this. Alex Sokolov had been alive when she had left his hotel suite. Maybe, as a matter of fact, she should say that no matter what. Because at some point Miranda would talk to the police, and Cassie knew that her stories should be consistent. So yes, this was the tale. This was what had happened. This was the lie. In the meantime, she would brace for impact. It was, she knew, inevitable.
Federal Bureau of Investigation. FD-302, redacted. Cassandra Bowden, flight attendant. Date, July 28, 2018. Cassandra Bowden, date of birth, social security number, telephone number. Was interviewed by properly identified special agents Frank Hammond and James Washburn at JFK International Airport, immediately upon her flight's arrival in the U.S. Hammond conducted the interview. Washburn took these notes. After being advised of the nature of the interview, Bowden provided the following information. Bowden said that she has been with the airline since she finished college 18 years ago, and this is the only job she has ever had. Bowden confirmed that Alexander Sokolov was seated in 2C on flight 4094 on Thursday, July 26th, from Paris to Dubai. He introduced himself to her on the plane before they took off. She said they met for the first time when the aircraft was still at the gate and passengers in the economy cabin were still boarding. He drank red wine, coffee, and water on the flight. She described him as low maintenance and said it was clear that he was traveling alone. She did not recall him speaking to the passenger across the aisle, 2D, or to the passenger beside him, 2B, but thought it likely if he spoke to anyone, it would have been 2B. She based this solely on her experience that passengers are more likely to speak to the person beside them than across the aisle. She said that she and Sokolov spoke mostly during the food service and talked almost entirely about the wine and entree and dessert choices. She characterized him as a polite and charming young man. She said he was a bit of a flirt and liked the uniform/dress she was wearing. He told her he worked for a hedge fund and had meetings in Dubai. He said something about clients and real estate holdings there, but added that what he did was just too boring to discuss. He did not say with whom he was meeting or where. Sokolov did not sleep on the plane, which she found normal because it was a daylight flight. She said he ate, he watched a movie, and he worked. She reported that she saw documents open on his laptop but she did not look at them. She saw no papers on his tray table. Likewise, she said that while she was aware that at one point he was watching a movie, she did not observe which one. Finally, she said he seemed calm and content, not at all agitated. She characterized the flight as completely uneventful.
Chapter 6. Usually the drug tests were random. Not every flight attendant and member of the flight crew was tested. One or two people would be singled out by an airline employee as they disembarked and asked to take what they called the whiz quiz. This was different. They were all tested, the entire crew, and all of their bags were searched. Everyone passed the drug test, and nothing illegal was found in any of their rollers or kits. It was odd, Cassie thought. It was strange. It was as if the FBI had no interest in knowing her whereabouts during the flight cruise overnight in Dubai. It was as if Frank Hammond and James Washburn had no reason in the world to suspect that she might have been with Alex Sokolov when he was killed. Hammond was a handsome guy roughly her age, with a countenance that had seemed slightly bemused, as if he had seen it all. His hair was short, the color of cinnamon, and just starting to recede. Washburn was younger, with pale, perfect skin, and rather professorial, rimless eyeglasses. The two of them acted as if they were concerned only with what she had seen of the man on the flight, and whether he had said something that might have been revealing. Did that mean they were hoping somehow to entrap her in a lie? It seemed not, because they never asked anything that would have necessitated one. Rather, it was as if they honestly didn't know that one of Alex's colleagues had come to the suite in Dubai and had a drink with her. In hindsight, she realized, her fear had been almost comic. They didn't even record the interview. Apparently, that was FBI policy. Hammond asked her questions, and Washburn wrote down her answers using a ballpoint pen and yellow legal pad as if it were 1955. When she had asked about the lack of a recorder, good God, they didn't even use their phones, Washburn had said later that he'd type it up on some form he called an FD-302. She wished she had been a little more detailed about Alex's and her flirting during the interview, but only because there was always the chance that one of the other crew members had mentioned it. Even her friend Megan might have said something. But Megan had insisted that her interview had been cursory, too. The agent who had talked to her was a woman named Anne McConnell, and Megan said that she had asked very little about the rest of the crew. Probably the real suspects were the employees who worked at the hotel, or perhaps the investors he was supposed to see in Dubai. Or maybe it was the desperate underground that risked Arabian justice to prey upon the scads of rich foreigners who descended upon the city daily. These were the sorts of people the Dubai police most likely were interested in. And in truth, it probably was one of them who had killed Alex. She could ruminate forever on why they had spared her, and probably never figure it out. It was best to let go of that sort of self-scrutiny. It wasn't helpful. But she couldn't exhale completely because there was still Miranda. At some point, that was the loose end that Cassie feared was going to trip her. As much as the ghost of Alex Sokolov might dog her, she knew if necessary she could drown that specter with an extra shot of Sip Smith or Jose Cuervo. But Miranda? She had shown up in the suite with a bottle of Stoli, glass chips of which were probably still embedded in that plush carpet in a room at the Royal Phoenician. By now, she had almost certainly said something to the Dubai police, and no amount of tequila or gin was going to make Miranda go away. She left her suitcase in the hallway of her apartment and pressed Frank Hammond's business card onto the refrigerator in her windowless kitchen with a magnet from the animal shelter. She wasn't sure what else to do with it. Then she went to her bedroom. The apartment was a small one-bedroom, but it had a valuable asset. It was on the 15th floor and had a magnificent, unobstructed view of New York Life's pyramidal gold cone and, a little further away, the Empire State Building. She'd come a long way from the bottom bunk in a crash pad in Queens. She kicked off her shoes and collapsed on her bed and gazed for a moment at the two buildings.